Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Metamoon podcast. I'm Emily, and I find this weird experience we call life completely fascinating. So I interview experts, teachers, creatives, and people with interesting stories so we can all make sense of what is happening here and how we can all enjoy the ride a little bit more. This week, I had a chat with Max Tang, a queer Chinese-American writer, speaker, and digital educator on self-love and trauma recovery for folks with intersectional identities. As a survivor of spiritual abuse, religious homophobia, ableism, and more, Max's eyes were first opened to the importance of intersectional trauma recovery when she was 19 and left her Chinese-American fundamentalist church, came out to her immigrant parents, and began recovering from situational mutism. All of this happened around the same time, and now she uses her blog and her Instagram page, Max Gets Curious, to create content that encourages fellow survivors of racial, queer, spiritual, and ableist traumas to heal and reclaim the kaleidoscope goodness of who they are. Max is so wise, and her message is so important for all of us as we strive to create a more inclusive, more accepting, and more trauma-informed world. So, without further ado, here's my conversation with Max Tang. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so happy to have you on and chat with you. I found you on Instagram and just been so inspired by your story and everything that you create. And I feel like it's just such a perfect fit for this podcast because so many of my audience and listeners have struggled a lot with anxiety. That's something that I talk about a lot and I get a lot of messages about. And it's been a big subject for a lot of my audience. So I thought it would be awesome for people to hear your story and some of what you've learned and healed from. And yeah, it's going to be really great.
Yeah.
So let's start with that, which is telling a little bit about the story of who you are and your journey with anxiety and how you've kind of come to be the person who sits with me today.
All right. Where do I begin? So I guess just currently in my online spaces, I love to talk about trauma recovery in a way that makes space for intersectionality and for the trauma of social injustice. And the idea behind it is kind of just that when it comes to trauma recovery, the personal is political too. So I love to talk about how the identities that we hold, especially when we have multiple marginalized identities, when our identities are intersectional, that can play a really significant and actually inseparable part of the trauma that we experience. You know, for me, a lot of the trauma that I experienced wasn't just because I'm Chinese or because my community was Christian growing up, but specifically because we were Chinese American Christians. And the second thing that I really like to explore is that we can experience trauma as a direct result of the identities that we have also, that social injustice can be traumatic too. So I talk about racial trauma, which is the trauma of racism, queer trauma, the trauma of homophobia, ableist trauma, and religious trauma, because those are my own personal experiences. And so the kind of, in a nutshell, how my story begins in reference to having situational mutism is I grew up in a really tight-knit, like, silly, loving Chinese-American, non-denominational church in suburban New Jersey. And there were a lot of pros and cons to living in that environment. You know, we would have a lot of like barbecues and Sunday night hangouts and pool parties and everything like that. It was, I think, at least for me as a kid, very warm environment to grow up in. I didn't just consider my like blood family to be my family, but also we would call each other brothers and sisters in Christ. So that was kind of my like faith family growing up. But I also grew up with something called situational mutism. So situational mutism is also known as selective mutism, but I call it situational mutism in my advocacy, just because I find that selective mutism can come with its own misconceptions. They just think that it's a more, it's just a better phrase. And there's a lot of people with SM who are switching over too. So situational mutism is a complex anxiety disorder that begins in really early childhood. And the gist of it is that, you know, when someone has SM, they become so anxious in certain social situations that they can't speak. But it's not just about being speechless. It also affects nonverbal communication. So it can be really hard to make eye contact or smile at a joke that you overheard, or make noise, or to like relax just when you're like sitting. So for me, what that looked like was, when I was in certain situations where I felt where my anxiety was peaked, I couldn't speak. So that was a lot of time at school or with strangers or like kids that I didn't know. and if you had like walked into a room while I was having a mute episode when I was a kid, I'd be sitting very stiff. My face would have this kind of like frozen expression. And if you tried to talk to me, I might not make eye contact with you. I probably wouldn't be able to respond back. And I would just kind of be like in my own zone. And from the outside, it might look like I was being really, I was just like very shy, or I was just being rude or something like that, or some people thought I was deaf. So the average age of onset for SM is between 2 and 4 years old. So I'm not sure exactly when my SM started, but I know that it was very early on. But I actually didn't learn that SM existed until age 19. So I went through being like a young child, teenager, and even a young adult having SM. And the reason why I never knew about SM is because growing up in a Chinese American Christian community, there's so much mental health stigma. So, you know, my parents don't, in my family, mental illness is a taboo, so it's never really spoken of. Even things like depression, if you shared openly about depression, that was seen to be kind of like stigma breaking or like pioneering in my community. And it's interesting looking back now, because I feel like depression is such a common experience. It's kind of like this baseline experience for me, at least. Like, it's become very easy for me to talk about depression because I feel like there's a lot more awareness about it, at least now. But back then, even depression and anxiety and things that many, many people experience on a daily basis, we couldn't talk about. My mom actually had a secret second sister that she never talked about. And I only found out that my mom had a second sister because we were on the way to the wedding of that sister's daughter who I'd never met. So I met her and then I helped her zip up the back of her wedding dress. Wow. And the reason that I didn't know about her secret second sister is because she was institutionalized for schizophrenia. So my mom just never talked about it. So that, but I use that just to kind of illustrate the power of mental health stigma, especially in a cultural kind of environment. My parents are first and second generation Chinese immigrants. So they never really got that much education about mental health, people who had mental illness. And people who had mental illness were seen to be kind of like those people, like they had done something wrong or something just unfortunate that happened to them. We just didn't talk about it. And people who had disabilities, I don't think we ever really talked about that either. So that was kind of like the cultural side of why I never got to learn about SM until age 19. And then there was also the religious side. So I remember when I was like a teenager in church, we started studying this book called Crazy Love by Francis Chan. And one of the messages of the book is that anxiety is a sin, like straight up. Mm-hmm. It's a sin of distrust in God's sovereignty. So is worry and, you know, other very human emotions. My family also had this belief that because Jesus, one of Jesus's names in the Bible is Wonderful Counselor, that meant that he was the only counselor that you would need as a Christian. Oh, wow. And so it was just this kind of confluence of like cultural lack of mental health awareness and also the religious doctrine that's really misinformed about not just mental health, but also like basic human emotions, like being able to feel anger or worry or things like that. And so the effect that that had on me growing up is that I just always assumed that having SM was my fault. Because, you know, I was never diagnosed with anything. I was never treated for having SM. And I didn't even know that it was a disorder until I was 19 and I was having a mute episode, and just all of like these decades of frustration just like, bubbled up in me. And I went on Google and I was like, I can't speak sometimes. Why? And, I went through like all these pages of results, and that's how I found out about situational mutism. And that was really life-changing for me. But up until that point, you know, as a kid, when other people around me didn't know about SM either, they would respond to my mute episodes as if I was just being difficult, or as if I was just boring, or I had no contribution to make, or I was just too shy and I was going to grow out of it. The danger of those misconceptions is that it can result in a lot of ostracism and belittling and abuse and mistreatment for people with SM. And for example, one of my caregivers growing up, when I would have a mute episode, sometimes they would ask me, like, what are you, a piece of furniture? Or they would punish me if I couldn't speak. Yeah. And so I just experienced so many different things when I was mute growing up as a result of other people's lack of awareness. You know, there are quite a few stories I could tell. I actually recently did an interview with Lucy Nathanson. She's a child therapist based in the UK, and she runs Confident Children. So she specializes in working with kids with SM. And there's a video up of an interview we did on her YouTube if anyone wants to hear, like, the super in-detail story of, you know, what it was like having SM and all that. I think just one story I can tell. Let me check my notes because there are so many things that I could say. as a kid, I, you know, like in school was where a lot of my SM was triggered. So instead of getting up to go to the pencil sharpener and sharpen my pencil, I felt like that was making too much noise. So I tried to sharpen my pencil in like the screw on the back of my chair for like years, which is like not effective. Don't try to do that. or I would like sit the whole day without going to the bathroom because raising my hand just felt too terrifying. I would try to like hype myself up to like raise my hand so many times throughout the day, and I wouldn't be able to do it. And then I would go home and like really need to use the bathroom, and that would happen so many times.
That would happen to me too. With anxiety.
Yeah.
I know how that goes.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty common anxiety experience in school. Or I would get zeros on my homework because I was too afraid to get up and put my papers into the bin, or I'd like miss the instructions and I wouldn't be able to ask anybody what the instructions were. And so, like, just throughout my life, people would get bored with me. They would kind of give up on me. They would make fun of me. They'd become offended by me. And when those people are not just your peers, but people who have authority over you, it becomes a really dangerous situation. I would be labeled like stubborn and rude and antisocial and arrogant. And all of these ways that people treated me as a result of their lack of awareness and stigma, kind of, I took all of it and I internalized it from like a very young age. So I blamed myself for being mute. I didn't understand why I couldn't speak, because I could speak in other situations, but I couldn't speak in others that seemed to be random. And so I just kind of bought into this belief that, you know, I was just like too shy, or it was like a lack of willpower. And I remember that, like, it got to the point where being labeled quiet had gained such a like negative connotation for me that I remember once I was taking a personality test in like a middle or high school class, and it told me that I was an INFP, and I went to the bathroom and cried because I thought that it was saying that being introverted was like an inherent part of who I was, and it was, it fed into this like internal battle that I'd always had between like, why can't I talk sometimes? And is that just like this inherent like lack or like flaw that I have that I'll never get over? Or, you know, is it something that I can change? Yeah. And yeah, so that was kind of like, that's like an overview of my struggle growing up as someone with SM in a Chinese American Christian community who, had no idea what SM was.
Yeah, that's amazing to hear. I feel like it's always crazy to me how powerful stories are, in the sense that like when we believe a certain story about something, or there's a community that has a certain like narrative about something, it really shifts the way that we see people and that we treat people. And that's why it's so important for us to all take responsibility for becoming informed about like marginalized groups, about disabilities, about all of this, because the stories that we're believing or told in our ignorance affect people's lives very, very strongly. And so it's very important to check ourselves on that and to make sure that we inform ourselves so we avoid causing trauma, because all those aspects of those identities and groups of that were all a huge part of who you were growing up, you can't separate those from your experiences, you know, that all played into what you had to learn and go through. It's a big part of that. So, I'm curious to know what has helped you the most in your journey kind of healing from this, if you still experience any episodes with anxiety, or what that looks like for you today, and how your healing journey has kind of brought you here.
Sure. So I think the first turning point for me was actually learning about SM.
Yeah.
Because, you know, for my whole life, I just blamed myself for being mute, for not being able to speak. And being mute in the context of SM is an incredibly isolating experience. Mm-hmm. So like the prevailing hypothesis right now about SM is that people who have SM tend to have really like inhibited temperaments, and people, let me just make sure that I'm saying this correctly. Where is it? Okay, I was right. People who have very inhibited temperaments also tend to have more sensitive amygdala. So that's the almond-shaped area of the brain that sets off your bodily response to danger. So the hypothesis is kind of that, you know, if someone has more sensitive amygdala to, you know, social stimuli, then people who are, you know, people you don't know or people who are like unknown or that your brain thinks are potentially dangerous will be read as danger. And then from there, your body kind of goes into this freeze response to protect you, which is why, you know, your voice shuts down and also why, like, your body shuts down. Like, you sit really stiffly and you don't have any, you don't give away any facial expressions, or, like, you won't make eye contact and things like that. It's, like, very visible, like, freeze response that your body goes into. And there's actually some findings that show that your, like, vocal muscles themselves become paralyzed, so you actually can't speak in these situations. But I didn't know any of that. And the people around me didn't know any of that either when I was growing up. So it was always just assumed that I was doing it on purpose. And I just can't emphasize enough how much I internalized, you know, like, all of the blame for the traumatic things that happened to me when I was mute that were done to me by other people. And also, like, the trauma itself of feeling like I couldn't, like, do so many things and not knowing why. And so when I found out about SM, it was literally like, it, like, changed, oops, it, like, changed my... my entire world. And I got into, like, these Facebook groups where people were talking about their experiences with SM, and I was like, oh my God, yes, all of these things have happened to me. All this time I thought I was the only person. I thought that I was sinful for having SM because I was just being selfish, but, like, there are all these other people out there experiencing this too. And so I guess another turning point was when I was studying abroad, and my friends and I went to see a drag show. And for some reason, after I saw the drag show, it triggered a mute episode. And I hadn't told anybody in my life, I think, at this point, that I had SM, because I was under the impression that in order to recover, I couldn't tell anybody that I had SM. Just, like, because I didn't want people to make accommodations for me. But we were sitting at this table, and I couldn't speak, and pretty quickly it became obvious that I couldn't speak. But since I hadn't told any of my friends about what I experienced, they, you know, didn't have that, like, background knowledge. And I was so terrified that they were going to, like, get upset with me or give up on me or move on. But it still makes me tear up. I think it really speaks to the power of inclusion.
Yeah.
But one of my friends, I remember, they didn't know anything about SM. I don't even know if they know that SM exists, like, in general. But they turned to me and asked, do you want distraction or do you want space? And I was able to, like, type out a response. And they just, like, sat with me for the rest of the night, and they ended up walking me back to my apartment. And before I went back up for the night, they pulled me into this, like, really deep hug, like one of those hugs that communicate something, like, that they care about you. And I went back into my apartment. I was just like, holy shit. Nobody had ever done that for me before. Like, nobody had ever asked what I needed or what I wanted. Or just, you know, sat with me through everything. And after I had that experience, I realized, you know, that first of all, like, people had the ability to do this for me my whole life, but this was the first time someone had done that for me. And I think I was 19 or 20 at that point. So I'd, like, pretty recently learned about SM. And there's this hashtag Access is Love that was started by three Asian American disabled activists, Mia Mingus, Alice Wong, and Sandy Ho. And the idea is that, you know, for people who have disabilities, accommodations and accessibility are not a burden or like an additional like item on your to-do list if you're someone who is not disabled. Access is a form of love, and that, you know, those like really simple things that my friend did for me that night, I think are the perfect illustration of why that matters. Yeah. And so after I had that experience, it kind of got my mind jogging about all the experiences that I'd had in the past. Like, why was this the first time that I'd had a positive response to a mute episode? So I started to look more into SM and to read some theories about how SM could actually be seen as a disability. And I had never thought of my SM as a disability before, you know, because it was always like, it's an anxiety disorder, it's a mental health disorder, and to me that was very separate from being a disability.
Yeah.
But the more I read, I realized that SM was a situational disability. And my experiences are different from people who have, you know, quote unquote, full-time disabilities. But at the same time, I started to see that I was carrying trauma in my identity from all of the self-blame and the self-hate that I had taken on as a kid when I had SM, and when I wasn't asked what I needed, or when I wasn't given any accommodation or inclusion. So that was really a turning point for me too. It was a very healing experience. Mm-hmm. And so my actual recovery, I had to educate my therapist at the time about SM. So SM, there's just very little awareness about SM in general, even among mental health professionals. So I, at age 19, there are no therapists who specialize in treating adults with SM that I know of. So I came up with like my own recovery program, and I went through it, and I like oversaw my own treatment in a way, because there is no, like, there's just nothing. Like, there's growing treatment and research for children with SM, because there are a lot of advocates for people who have SM, but most of them are parents or professionals who have never had SM. And most of them focus so much on children or teenagers, but not really adults. And people like me who are adults and never got any diagnosis or treatment growing up because there's such a lack of awareness. You know, you don't grow out of SM. It just becomes more entrenched over time. And there are a lot of people like me out there who are adults and who still experience SM. But since there are so few resources, I came up with like my own recovery routine and did that. And I do consider myself recovered now. but I've become an advocate because I see a lot, not just in my own experiences with people who have no awareness of SM, but also advocates who are parents of professionals and have never had SM are kind of under the impression that being speechless makes you voiceless. And it was only through learning about, you know, I took this sign language class in New Zealand. So I know like the tiniest bit of New Zealand sign language. and I just remember watching my teacher, and she could make us all crack up, you know, and she never had to say a word. She was so full of personality, and it was all like embodied.
Yeah.
All of her communication was embodied. And I just remember taking that class and learning to embody my own voice. And it really like set off a light bulb in my head that all of that time that I had been treated as if I was voiceless or as if I had no contribution to make, people had just assumed that because I was speechless, that I was voiceless. Mm-hmm. And I believe the same thing too. But while I was learning sign language, I realized, you know, there are so many other ways that we communicate,
yeah.
even when we have SM. Not being able to speak or to make eye contact or like sitting really stiffly and having that like body language of like, I'm scared, that is communication too. And people with SM sometimes choose to, you know, use sign language or to write on paper or to write out text messages, or we'll create art or we'll write letters. And those are all forms of communication too.
Mm-hmm.
But there is so much emphasis on the spoken voice as being the highest form of communication, like the most superior form of communication, which is actually something called autism.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned about that in my sign language class when I was learning about how kids in New Zealand schools for the deaf were prevented from using the sign language that they invented for themselves. Mm. And this is something that happened in many different countries, so the U.S. too. And so I started to learn about how, like, actually a lot of my experiences had been rooted in autism too. Not just a lack of awareness, but this belief that, you know, if you're not talking to me, then you're not really communicating to me or you're not really respecting me.
Mm-hmm.
When in reality, I had just needed somebody to see what I was experiencing or to ask what I needed or ask how I would like to communicate. And I think I only had ever had one teacher do this for me once. And that also was a really healing experience. But it was through learning about all of these things and finally putting language to all of the things that I had experienced that really jump-started my ability to heal my inner child from the trauma of ableism and autism and lack of awareness that I still carry. Now something that I really focus on is advocacy of people with SM from the standpoint that being speechless doesn't make us voiceless, and that all people with SM have a voice, and we just need to listen in different ways and to ask people how they want to communicate and what they need.
Yeah.
Because that was what I always needed. And when my friend did that for me in New Zealand for the first time, it was so life changing. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's interesting how much it can be so helpful to just have people around us who can care for us in a way or ask, you know, the right thing of just showing support. And a lot of that again comes down to just people being informed that of how to deal with people who might have a disability or anxiety even, or something that they maybe feel scared of or just haven't been informed about, that all of that creates the traumatic behavior of how people react. Because it's one thing to go through everything that you were feeling internally in these moments and the trauma of that, to have the additional trauma of the people around you and the people that you love react in a way that enforces that idea that there's something wrong with you. And that ties into just ableism, like this belief in this story that people are supposed to be a certain way, and there's like a normal, healthy way to be a person, and that all of these differences don't fit into that. So do you want to talk a little just on the idea of ableism for anybody who maybe...
Sure.
That's a new concept to them?
Yes. So ableism is prejudice and discrimination in a way that paints disabled people as inferior or burdensome or childlike or as not having a full human experience or as, you know, always needing help and not having anything to contribute. I am not the best person to give like an academic definition of ableism, but that is the definition that I usually use in my own work. So ableism shows up in many different ways. So it can show up interpersonally. For example, a mother who has a child who, you know, wants to use mobility aids or a wheelchair, but because the mother believes that disability is, you know, something to be ashamed of or something to be hidden, she doesn't allow the child to use mobility aids. That's an example of interpersonal ableism. Institutional ableism is another form of ableism. One immediate example is, you know, of a school not allowing its deaf students to use sign language, or of, you know, a city not, you know, refusing to make their buildings accessible, which is continues to be a really big problem. And there's also just, you know, the ideology of itself of ableism, which is something that you can see, unfortunately, nowadays during COVID, when there's talk about how, you know, hospitals might not have enough equipment to take care of everybody, then, you know, the question arises of, like, how do doctors choose who to treat and who to not treat? And, you know, if you go into the, if God forbid you go into the comment section of a social media post that talks about that, you can see people saying, you know, like, treat people with the highest life expectancy, or, you know, treat people with the best health. And what that really means is, you know, if you have a non-disabled person and a disabled person, and there's only one set of equipment left, then they should let the disabled person die. And there are many ways that disabled people are being affected or dying as a result of ableism and as a result of just like COVID-19 in general. But yeah, that's kind of a overview of what ableism is.
Hey, so this podcast is all about interviews, but if you're looking for more concise and potent lessons and resources and pieces of research-based wisdom to help support your healing journey, I make a weekly audio lesson for the members of my private club. As a club member, you can also ask me questions and make requests for specific topics that you want support on. This is my most affordable offering at only $5 a month. People always say that's the cost of a cup of coffee, but I live in LA and it's like $8 for a latte. But anyways, this is the perfect next step for all of you who are just wanting to go deeper but are on a tight budget. So to join the club, click the link in the show notes or go to patreon.com/metamoon. All right, let's get back to the conversation.
I would love to talk about intersectionality and trauma recovery. That's something that you talk a lot about and the importance about that. But so let's talk a little bit about intersectionality.
Okay. So intersectionality, the term itself was coined by Kimberly Crenshaw in 1989. She's a Black feminist legal scholar, and she was writing a paper about how the law sees discrimination, specifically against Black women. She used this one case. She used several cases, but one of them was this case of a Black woman who faced discrimination from a business. And under the law, their case was only approached from either the vantage point of sex discrimination or through racial discrimination. But the reality is that they were discriminated against specifically because they were Black women. You know, you couldn't divorce either categorization and still be able to see the injustice that happened accurately. So the idea of intersectionality itself has kind of grown since then. It's the idea that the social identities that we hold, like race or class or gender or religion or sexuality, all of those identities can overlap with each other and create these unique experiences of discrimination or disadvantage that you couldn't see if you only looked through one lens, or looked at one identity. And I talk a lot about intersectionality in my work because I first saw it in my own story. The trauma that I went through didn't really happen the way it did only because I'm Chinese or only because my community was Christian, but specifically because we are Chinese American Christians. And so after I came out to my parents, the story in a nutshell is that there was a really negative reaction, and I ended up having to kind of like begin a new life, become financially independent, all these things. And so after I came out, people would say things to me like, I don't understand how a parent can choose their religion over their child. And my gut reaction to when people said things like this to me was, I understand that they're coming from a good place, and I also understand how it can be kind of alluring to like simplify a situation like this down into one statement like that. But it also didn't capture the full reality of my situation, you know, because my parents didn't react to my coming out with anger and derision just because they're religious. They're like traditional Chinese understanding of a parent-child relationship also plays into everything that happened. You know, the like Confucianist idea that, in a parent-child relationship, the child should always be deferential to the parent, that, the child is obligated to be in relationship with the parent, to care for the parent, to listen to the parent, to obey their wishes. And so, you know, my coming out to them was not just about religion. It was also, the cultural homophobia that they carry from like their traditional Chinese upbringing about what it means to be queer. It's also like the expectation within our culture that kids will have their own kids and give their parents' grandchildren, that they'll carry on the family name. That's very important. That's also a pressure that a lot of people face in China and Hong Kong when they're queer, to kind of like, you know, hide their sexuality and to, you know, get married and have kids because that is their like family responsibility. And then there is also the whole aspect of like needing to save face for our family, not wanting to like tarnish our family reputation by me openly saying that I'm queer. So there are so many different things that went into their reaction to my coming out and to the trauma that I experienced. And it was, you know, when I started going to therapy, I found myself having to explain these dynamics to my white therapist, you know, both like the cultural side of things and then also the religious side of things, you know, because for my parents, they are our church is like a fundamentalist Chinese American church. And so like for people who truly believe that hell is real, if you really love someone, then you will do anything that it takes to prevent them from going there. And you know, so their definition of love is fundamentally different from the kind of love that I need. And so I had to explain like both of those dimensions to my white therapist, because for some reason I couldn't find a Chinese therapist, even though I was determined to find one. And, you know, even though I wish that I had had that I could have a therapist who is culturally competent or shares those cultural experiences with me, the practice of explaining it was actually really helpful for me because I started to put language to these things that had always gone unspoken in my life, like the cultural side of things, the religious side of things. And I realized that I'd never actually explored my own identities within my trauma recovery or realized just how much my identities like shaped everything that I went through. And I just had this realization that my body is not an empty stage upon which trauma plays out. I experienced trauma from my Chinese American Christian community, and I really needed to contend with my own identities in order to understand my story and to create a path to my own healing. And so that's why I'm really passionate about intersectionality within trauma recovery, because I think a lot of the time within trauma recovery, we can kind of gloss over the identities that we have and the fact that, like, you know, sometimes things happened the way they happened specifically because of those identities that we have. You know, if I had been in a white fundamentalist Christian community, then the things that I had to contend with and the trauma that I went through would have been different. And something else that I realized while I was talking with my therapist about these experiences and the importance of, like, the intersectional experiences that I had within my trauma is that, you know, homophobia itself is also traumatic. That, you know, homophobia didn't just fuel the trauma that I had. And the same can be said of ableism. Like, ableism didn't just fuel the traumatic actions that others took in my life or the traumatic situations that were set up, but they were also inherently traumatic. And while I was learning about spiritual abuse and complex trauma, which are things that I have gone through, you know, learning about complex trauma itself, complex trauma is trauma that happens repeatedly or for an extended period of time. And it's similar to PTSD, but complex PTSD is its own distinct thing that comes with its own distinct challenges as well. And when I was learning about complex PTSD, I started to think about how, you know, how come it has been so easy for me to look at, like, all of these, like, the system of abuse that I've gone through. Like, I can look at this pattern of behavior that I've experienced and see that that is abuse. But when I think about, you know, just to use my SM as an example, to be somebody who was, like, moving through the world every day among people who didn't understand my disorder, and, you know, having, like, teachers and caregivers and peers and even, like, fellow EMTs, like, people who should have known better, didn't know better, to constantly have to be going through all of those experiences and to be told that I was inferior, that I was a burden, or that I was selfish, or that I was arrogant because of my disability for, like, all of those years. Why have I never heard about ableism as a potential cause of complex trauma or trauma itself? When we talk about trauma, a lot of the time we think of, like, war or abuse or neglect or natural disasters, these, like, concrete incidents where someone fears outright for their safety or their life. But in reality, like, to be somebody who was marginalized, living in a society where from all different members of society, you can face this whole array of prejudice and discrimination and abuse. And then to also live in a society where there are laws that discriminate against you, where the media pretends that you don't exist or that, you know, you shouldn't be shown on screen, to have, like, the institutions around you, like schools or courthouses or what have you, also discriminate against you or refuse to include you or to be accessible to you. Why do we not talk about social injustice itself as a cause of trauma? And so yeah. I started to really dive into all of these things. That's how I learned about racial trauma and how I started to learn about ableism and homophobia as causes of trauma as well. And that is why intersectionality is so important to me within trauma recovery, yeah. Because, you know, I had to kind of discover all of this information for myself, Because there's just not really that much research about sociocultural trauma, you know, the trauma of social injustice. And even with my own therapist, it's something that I continually have to, you know, share my experiences and explain my viewpoint, things like that. And I just wanted to have a space where, you know, I could write out the things that I was learning about and the things that I had experienced and create a space for other people to have these conversations. You know, so that's what Mexico's Curious has become.
Yeah, it's what you're doing is amazing and so important, because for people to be able to learn about these things and maybe discover some truth about themselves in something that they're learning about, that's such a huge part of the healing process. And these things are complicated. Mm-hmm. Like you said, it's not just
so complicated.
Simple solution. To healing, it's very layered. There's a lot of different things that impact that. And when we don't know about it, we tend to just think that there's something wrong with us, and it makes it difficult for us to heal. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
it's really amazing what you're doing.
Yeah.
So I have some rapid fire questions for you, and then we'll close up.
All right.
You ready?
Yes.
All right. The first one is, what or who is God to you now?
An idea.
Why are we here?
The magic of science and serendipity. But I'm a little biased because I'm an IVF kid, so that's what it is for me.
That's a great answer. What is our biggest mistake as human beings?
Thinking that we're always right.
Facts. So true. What advice would you give your younger self?
There is a piece that I wrote recently for the end of this spiritual abuse support group that I was in. And there's a line that I wrote to my younger self that went something like, I love your anger. Your anger is like a song drifting divine and electric through the dark. I know that you think your anger makes you selfish, but I need you to know that your anger saves us.
Oh, I love, is the whole thing posted anywhere on the internet?
Yeah, it's on my Instagram.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to go read it. That's amazing. What's your most non-negotiable habit or practice?
Okay, so as part of my trauma recovery, I've been learning about, like, my interests and the things that bring me joy. This is very, unexpected, but I love, like, dumb frogs. Like, I just love, like, derpy frogs. So every That's time, awesome. You might be able to see, I have like a silly frog planter on my bookcase.
Oh, nice.
But I've started to collect awesome. Like weird frog things. Like, for instance, I recently bought this off of a frog spotting. It's a Facebook group.
That's
so,
amazing.
Yeah, I love derpy frogs. And I really
have
want to have like a garden
TikTok?
Full of like dumb frog figurines.
Yes.
So I think, that's an obsession that I've discovered through trauma recovery. It's brought a lot
that's
of happiness
great.
To my life.
Have you ended up on frog TikTok?
I have not, but I really need to get on
that's
it.
That's like a thing. That's a thing. Frog TikTok. Okay, and then the last one is your all-time favorite book.
His Dark Materials, I guess a series by Philip Pullman. But if I had to choose one book, oh my God, I think it might have to be the second one.
Awesome. And then my final question that I ask everybody is that if I told the whole world, or if I told you that the whole world is listening to you right now,
no pressure.
What would you tell them? Yeah, easy question. I end with the easy one.
There's this therapist that I love that I followed for a couple of years. His name is Brian Peck. His handle is Room to Thrive. And he also co-founded the Religious Trauma Institute. So if anyone is interested in religious trauma recovery, definitely recommend that you look into it. But he has this post, and I'm going to paraphrase it. And it basically says, never hold your own beliefs so tightly that you can't see another person's humanity. Just really love the way that he put that. And
beautiful.
I think that, you know, as a former fundamentalist Christian, that's definitely something that I did so many times. But I don't think that you need to be religious or a religious fundamentalist to do that. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of polarization nowadays, and I just think it's good advice for the long run.
Yeah, we all have our beliefs.
Yeah.
All of us, even if they're unconscious, they're there. Beautiful. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here. This is a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you guys so much for listening. Remember, you can always watch these interviews on the MetaMoon YouTube channel. And if you ever have thoughts, suggestions, requests, anything, just reach out to me on social media at emily.capshaw. Until next time, remember, you are safe, you are loved, and you have everything you need within you.